Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, over the rainbow, gotta let it go. So far,
rain's a gun.
Fast to freedom.
Stars tonight.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate Rewind and Rewatch, episode 41, covering Open the Ultimate Gate 2013 from Secaucus, New Jersey at the Meadowlands Expo Center on April 6, 2013. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling feed or our own dedicated podcast feed on all podcast platforms or applications. You can find us on Twitter at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, there's no obligation whatsoever. Just click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our Red Circle website, and you just click the red box that says sponsor the show. You can do a one-time and reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever again, but we'd like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Iron Mike Spears. Joined as always by my friend and co-host, Case Lowe. And Case, we are probably at the most consequential Dragon Gate USA show before the end of the promotion. It's Ultimate Gate 2013, the by far one of the biggest shows in the company's history. And it's taken us now, we're episode 41, and boy, did this card feel a little bit different to me watching it now 7 years later than I did live.
It's crazy. I think when we started this project,
there were a few marquee shows that we knew we were going to hit, and a lot of them were obviously the first two shows, Phoenix WrestleMania weekend, more so just because of the Davey situation than anything that actually happens on those shows. You have the Danielson matches. You've got, I will say, some stuff with Ronan that I knew was going to be on the radar, and specifically Gargano winning the Freedom Gate title from Yamato at the end of 2011. But the other one is Ultimate Gate 2013, and it's hard to believe that, you know, we're now at a point where we've hit this show, we've watched everything up to this point, and we are now here for what was the largest attendance Dragon Gate USA ever had. Probably, and I don't know this for sure, but judging from what Dave alludes to in The Observer, the most bought iPay-per-view Dragon Gate USA ever had, and just a really big show, one that I think up top, just my brief thought is that it captured the essence of what Dragon Gate USA was trying to do, probably more than any other show since the first anniversary show in July of 2010 with the four-way freestyle with Chikara versus Kamikaze USA and with Danielson versus Shingo in the main event. We've obviously loved a bunch of shows in the middle there, but it seems like the initial thought process of what Dragon Gate USA would have been, which is these spot shows that feature supercar-type matches a few times a year, especially on WrestleMania weekend, it seems like this is the show that fits that model more than any of them in just about 3 years.
Yeah, and it's real interesting comparing it to that first anniversary show, because there's a lot of similarities, and we'll get into it when we get into the card itself. It's just kind of a remarkable thing getting to this point in this, and it's something that, like, I have cherished, like, the hidden gems that we found, but this was kind of one of the things I was really looking forward to when launching this project with you, is be able to watch, like, these big touchstone shows with, like, clear eyes, with enough distance that, you know, I could have a different evaluation for it, and it's all very, very interesting, and especially, I mean, just top to bottom, it's one of the most jam-packed shows they would ever have. So I'm glad we're going to get to talk about it. But this is WrestleMania week in 2013, Case, and it's the launch of something new. And Case, we have a bunch of stuff that we kind of want to go over before we get into the show itself, Case. So where do you want to start off with?
Well, it's the first WrestleMania weekend that feels like a WrestleMania weekend. And we talked about in Phoenix during the first one in 2010, where it was literally just Ring of Honor and Dragon Gate USA running. And then in 2011, it was Ring of Honor at Center Stage and Dragon Gate USA in their their low ceiling facility that impacted those shows greatly. 2012, there was some Wrestle Reunion stuff going on in Miami, but it was still just primarily Dragon Gate USA and Ring of Honor. And this year, we have the first year of WrestleCon, which housed Chikara, CZW, Dragon Gate USA, Evolve, and Shimmer. If you remember from WrestleMania weekend 2012, there is a moment where Lenny Leonard, DJ Hyde, and Shima stood in the ring with one another, which is my favorite moment in the history of Dragon Gate USA. They announced all of these promotions with Chikara being the promotion that, when that was announced, it was like the Beatles were reuniting. The Chikara pop was unbelievable. Now, a year later, they're all in Secaucus, New Jersey. And then you also have Ring of Honor running the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. And you also have Pro Wrestling Syndicate running in New Jersey as well at the SMG Sportsplex. I will read this note in The Observer real quick that Dave says, "One person close to WrestleCon noted that it is amazing how much money fans were spending. The belief now is that for independents, this is going to be very much like Christmas for merchants in the sense that they'll work year-round trying to stay even, with all the real profits being made in one weekend, or perhaps one big weekend and a big Christmas season." So, Mike, just off the bat, that is what WrestleMania weekend has become 7.5 years later. This is the foundation for it, right?
Right, yeah. If the Davey incident in 2010 in Phoenix between Ring of Honor and DGUSA was kind of the launching of the idea of PWG as super indie Switzerland and the idea of the first schism towards WrestleMania weekend, this is the full maturation of it. Because when we just like look back into 2020, all the companies that were heavily reliant on having a WrestleMania in Tampa and the aftermath of COVID-19, I mean, you could directly say that there would probably still be an Evolve in some fashion if WrestleMania 2020 wasn't canceled, because how reliant that at least Gabe's business model became based off of the WrestleMania weekend just business. So yeah, no, I mean, this is incredibly prescient, and I mean, for the next 6 years, this kind of has been what WrestleMania and a little bit towards SummerSlam, but not as much, weekend has been.
So we're going to go in chronological order here of all the shows that took place this weekend. And we start on April 4th, 2013 with Pro Wrestling Syndicate. I would imagine this is the only time we talk about this promotion, but it's WrestleMania weekend and there are a few matches on this show, on these two shows, they run a double shot, that I feel are worth mentioning. So on night one, you had the opening match, Trent Beretta, fresh off of his WWE release, and we'll be talking about him more later on in the show. Trent Beretta defeats Sanjay Dutt. You had a match where Dan Moff, in the year 2013, defeated Kevin Steen in 6 minutes. Starman won the PWS Tri-State title from Alex Reynolds. Mike, are you familiar with the man behind the mask of Starman?
I would argue that probably everyone who is listening to this show knows who this is, and he's talked about it openly. We're not playing a Lanza Silver Ant thing. It's Joey Janela.
Yes, Joey Janela making his presence felt WrestleMania weekend 2013. There was an ECW revival match with John Morrison defeating Elijah Burke. I guarantee that match was horrible, but the matches that closed out this show all sound pretty good, with the Rock and Roll Express defeating the Briscoe Brothers in just under 4 minutes. Kevin Matthews retaining the PWS heavyweight title against Colt Cabana in a three-way match, your main event, Jushin Thunder Liger, and pay attention to these names that he defeats in a triple threat match. Jushin Thunder Liger defeats Anthony Nice and Davey Richards. So Mike, that is PWS night one. Those matches that I listed, there are a few more on the show, but they weren't super important. Is that getting you in the door if you've figured out transportation, if it is just a matter of whether or not you want to go to this show or not? Are you going to this show?
If I didn't see the runtime of the main event and that tag match, I could be convinced. But
yes,
looking at like the runtime of everything, this was a show that nothing got time whatsoever. And that would be a real bummer, because Liger kind of was the first like big fly-in for WrestleMania weekend. And getting to see him against Nice, who at this point, we'll be talking a lot about Anthony Nice over the next few weeks, and Davey Richards, like, that's not necessarily a dream match, but if you get an opportunity to see Jushin Thunder Liger live in that context, you're taking it. So, disappointing. I would have probably forked over my $20 and then been really mad afterwards.
Yeah, I think that is a fair assessment. Night two does not look as solid. I'll just run through the matches here that caught my eye, which was Kevin Matthews retaining the heavyweight title over Anthony Nice, who is going to be talked about a lot on this show. Craig Steele defeated John Silver. Alex Reynolds defeated Trent Beretta. John Morrison defeats Jushin Thunder Liger in your semi-main event. In your main event, a singles match, which was dubbed at the time as the New Jack retirement match, in 10 minutes in 2013, mind you, not 2003, New Jack defeats the Necro Butcher.
And kind of the remarkable thing about this weekend is the number that's thrown for PWS makes it, I believe, the second largest show of the peripheral WrestleMania things behind Ring of Honor for this. So, like, especially for someone like New Jack in the tri-state area, that's a huge thing. I'm kind of disappointed that you did not bring up Chris Chetty and Nova defeating Starman and the Hurricane. I mean,
I was going to pretend that match didn't exist.
New Jersey as hell. And then Pat Buck versus Tommy Dreamer in a hardcore match. I know that there is a lot of people who would be very excited to get their hands on that match from 2013 just because of how probably atrocious it was.
I can't imagine anything worse. But, you know, according to the cage match attendance numbers, this second show, which happened on April 5th, 2013, drew about 1,600 fans, actually a little bit more according to the cage match numbers, which is incredible considering that it ran the same night as Evolve 19, ROH Supercard of Honor, and CZW at WrestleCon. So let's dive into those, and let's start with Evolve 19 crowning a champion. You know, Mike and I have not been rewatching the Evolve shows that fell into our timeline just because that would be too much, and because I don't want to do that either. But, you know, one of the reoccurring themes that has bled into Dragnet USA is that all these Evolve wrestlers want a title, and they want a title that represents this promotion. the stuff that we've seen, I think, has been super confusing. I don't understand this storyline. Either give them a title or don't, or just wrestle for the Freedom Gate title. Like, I really don't understand why this was a prominent angle in the world of Evolve Wrestling. I also just don't... It's another Gabe Sapolsky tournament where the bracket doesn't make any sense, where there's...
Yeah, let's talk about the bracket for a second, because it is probably the most Gabe brain thing we've ever come across.
So there's one bye. The top seed got a bye, like the NFL playoffs this year, and that top seed was Chuck Taylor, who wrestled on the first Evolve show in a preliminary match where the match didn't count towards his rankings, and then ever since then, he's been on a tear in Evolve. He beat Claudio Castagnoli. He wrestled Johnny Gargano at Evolve 9. It is weird to think, even in the early days with the Brian Danielson inspired version of Evolve, that Chuck Taylor was a featured player in that promotion, but he was. So Chuck Taylor got the first seed. There was a match to determine his opponent, which would have been an Evolve four-way freestyle match that opened up this show with Sami Callihan, Jigsaw, Rich Swann, and Samurai Del Sol. Mike, now this is where I'm not looking at the physical bracket, and perhaps that is my fault, but you're looking at the results of this show as well. How does Ricochet get into the second round? What did I miss here?
I think the first two seeds got a bye.
That's my bad. The first two seeds got a bye.
Right, yeah. And the way it went is that Chuck gets to face the winner of the four-way, because the idea that that person will be more beat up and beat down, and yes, this is as convoluted as we're saying. Instead of just having a simple eight-person, three-round tournament, this is the way Gabe has us deal with it. And then the idea there is that Ricochet gets to face the other person who has a kind of a qualifying match for the semifinals. Like, the way I look at this tournament, and probably the best way to visualize it, is it's essentially a four-man tournament with two play-in matches, one, both of those being that four-way match, and then the other quarterfinal matchup.
Yeah, I think it would have just made more sense to either... They do a four-way and a singles match, and the answer would have been to either do two four-ways or two singles matches, but the way they have it, with Callihan defeating Jigsaw, Swann, and Del Sol, and then AR Fox winning by DQ over John Davis to advance, it is just so needlessly complicated. And this is a show that I remember at the time leaving a bad taste in the fans' mouth. Just, you know, there was really nothing wrong with this show. I'm sure Evolve over its history has had worse shows, but this was a show that, because of what we're about to talk about, just did a lot of damage to the purple and silver brand. And I will read from Dave in The Observer here, where he says, "There were major problems on the internet pay-per-view side. WWN spent $2,200 for an internet connection to the building, but didn't get everything they needed until 90 minutes before the Evolve show started. Then there were problems, and none of the building's tech people were there. Because the feed wasn't working, they delayed the start of the show by 30 minutes, which killed the crowd. Then they decided they had to start the show, even though the feed wasn't working. For the people who ordered the show, they joined the four-way opener, which was a part of the one-night tournament in progress. There was another outage during the Young Bucks versus Super Smash Brothers match, including the last 5 minutes of the match. The general feeling was that the show was good live, but it was a frustrating watch on iPay-per-view. AR Fox pinned Sami Callihan in the tournament final to be crowned the first Evolve champion. Fox got to the finals first by beating John Davis via DQ, then pinning Ricochet. Callihan had won the four-way over Samurai Del Sol, Rich Swann, and Jigsaw, then beat top seed Chuck Taylor. It should also be noted, and this plays into the show that we're talking about today, the first Dragon Gate show on April 6th lost most of the Rich Swann versus Brian Kendrick match, but the finish aired, and from there it was good, and the second Dragon Gate USA show played much better. There were a lot of iPay-per-view issues, but even with the problems on the Evolve show and the first Dragon Gate USA show, the company did its best numbers in a very long time. So with all that in mind, let me quickly summarize the results of Evolve 19. Callihan won that four-way. AR Fox defeated John Davis via DQ. Brian Kendrick and Johnny Gargano teamed up to defeat Drew Gulak and Orange Cassidy. Sami Callihan defeated Chuck Taylor. This is the match where Callihan worked an injury during his entrance, where he fell off the turnbuckle and tweaked his knee. to make people think it was a shoot, but then Chuck Taylor spent the entire match working his knee, so people knew from there that it wasn't anything. AR Fox then defeated Ricochet in the tournament semifinals. A no DQ match where Eric Cannon beat Scott Reed in 7 minutes. Then the semi-main event, that hype tag match that no one watching on the iPay-per-view saw. The Super Smash Brothers defeated the Young Bucks. And finally, to crown your first Evolved champion, AR Fox defeated Sami Callihan.
And you know, this is the path of AR Fox in this tournament makes complete sense with how things were portrayed in DGUSA. I mean, Davis being like the outlier there, he defeats Ricochet, who is the person that consumed most of his 2012, and he defeats Sami Callihan, the person that consumed most of his 2011. So the booking of that is kind of fine. Having Chuck Taylor, like, after all that drama about him wanting the number one seed, going out in the first round is as pure Gabe as you get. I don't remember ever watching this show, but it just was something that at this time I was like, all right, I looked this card and I was like, I see enough of most of these guys elsewhere, and I don't feel like this Evolved title is going to mean something. And now, 6 years later, I was kind of finally proven right about it.
It's a show that if you watch it, especially in contrast to the Open the Ultimate Gate 2013 show, where it seems like the crowd, even if they don't follow Dragon Gate USA on an intimate level, they really want this show to be good, and they're actively helping the show in certain parts. Evolve 19, because it started late, because of the Sami Callihan worked injury thing, because of just the convoluted nature of the tournament, that is a crowd that almost seems to be rooting against that show. It is an uncomfortable watch, and for as many hidden gems as there are in the Evolve library, Evolve 19 is not one of them.
No. And it kind of, I mean, had this sheen of about it that it took a real long time, and pretty much the death of DGUSA, I would feel like, to get over the sheen of like the first, I don't know, 24 Evolve shows, because this one very much is kind of further just illustrated why there was this problem that they had within Evolve. And then, I mean, you had the iPay-per-view issues, which Gabe had a pretty good string from 2012 to 2013 of less iPay-per-view issues, and then, you know, just came to a head with him in Secaucus.
Yeah, the iPay-per-view issues are only going to get worse from Gabe from here on out, as is Evolve. We'll talk about this as we go along, but Evolve has a really troubling 2013, and there are some Evolve shows, 23 and 24 in particular, that I would love to know what the live iPay-per-view buys were at the time, and just how many people have seen those shows, because the impression that I get is that Evolve 23 and Evolve 24... let's just say not a lot of people watch those shows as it happened, but there's another promotion happening this weekend that is in limbo a little bit, but they're kind of on the upswing, and that is Ring of Honor, who ran the Hammerstein Ballroom on April 5th, 2013. But I do want to talk about something before we get to the Hammerstein show, which Dave has us all in the April 8th Wrestling Observer newsletter, where Dave says, Charlie Haas quit the promotion / was fired abruptly after an incident on the March 30th show in Asheville, North Carolina. Haas, 41, was reportedly belligerent backstage, and there was also something of a chasm between Haas and Shelton Benjamin with the regulars, since they kind of kept to themselves and they didn't view the promotion with the same attitude that the regulars did. It would be impossible for someone to come from WWE to have the same attitude towards Ring of Honor, and Haas and Benjamin were only there because Cornette wanted some name recognition with their new TV audience. Dave says, the incident from internal accounts appeared to start at the March 3rd television tapings in Chicago Ridge from a match with Haas and Grizzly Redwood. Redwood was upset because he thought he was going to get more offense in. It was supposed to be a one-sided match, but he only got a few moves in. When Haas came in, he was described as being belligerent and, worse, was rubbing people the wrong way. Redwood, who was the smallest guy in the promotion, was said to have instigated things and that he knocked Haas's hat off of his head and stomped on it. Haas struck Redwood or got into a fight with him. There were a lot of versions, but the one we heard was it was not a closed fist punch, but a hard backhanded slap, hard enough that Redwood was bleeding from it. And this all happened on that Asheville, North Carolina show on March 30th. It was immediately broken up, but Booker Hunter Johnson was furious, and he and Haas got into a loud shouting match. This took place while the fifth match on the show was in the ring, but a lot of fans at the show could hear it going on. Kevin Kelly, who was at the show and has known both Charlie and his brother Russ dating back to when they worked for Jim Kettner in Delaware, tried to defuse the situation and talk him into leaving. Haas refused to leave, and eventually they came to the conclusion it would be easier if he just did the match since he was insistent on it. He faced Jeff Neal, a local worker and who is an area radio personality who worked a radio angle with Haas to set up the match. Haas was supposed to win, but instead, Haas put Neal over with a roll-up clean in the middle. Haas did some mic work, but they cut his mic off, and he stayed in the ring and continued talking loud enough for everyone to hear him. He said he was retiring immediately, that it's time for him to be a husband and a father, and that next week's match with Shelton Benjamin on the iPay-per-view wasn't happening. He thanked the fans and a lot of the locker room, but called Kevin Kelly an office stooge, ripped on Booker Hunter Johnston, as well as Nigel McGuinness, who he doesn't get along with. He said he was trading in his wrestling trunks for hospital scrubs, and apparently Haas had just taken a well-paying job in the medical profession. So, Mike, that all leads us to the Super Card of Honor show, and I'll run down these results, and then we could just do a big Ring of Honor think piece for a second. But this show happened at the Hammerstein Ballroom, April 5th, 2013, Super Card of Honor 7, with ACH and TD Thomas defeating QT Marshall and RD Evans in the opener. Mike Bennett ended up replacing Charlie Haas, and he defeated Shelton Benjamin in 7:42. Number one contendership match, Michael Elgin defeats Jay Lethal. There was a 10-man tag match with Scum, who we talked about extensively on our last episode, represented by Cliff Compton, Jimmy Jacobs, Jimmy Rave, Rhett Titus, and Rhino. They defeated BJ Whitmer, Caprice Coleman, Cedric Alexander, Mark Briscoe, and Mike Mondo. Carl Anderson of New Japan Pro Wrestling, he came in and he defeated Roderick Strong. There was a three-way elimination TV match for the TV title, with Taven defeating Adam Cole and Matt Hardy. RH World Tag Team titles, Red Dragon defeated the American Wolves yet again. And your main event, RH World title, Kevin Steen drops the belt after 11 months, and he drops it to Jay Briscoe.
It's an interesting weekend. This kind of, the whole Charlie Haas and Asheville thing, hey, I've been saying for a long time, the Carolinas are weird. Of course that happened in Asheville. Like, how couldn't it happen in Asheville, North Carolina? You know, like, it just lines up perfectly for that. And then, yeah, you take a look at this the Supercard of Honor show, and it's interesting. Like, of course, Carl Anderson coming in a solid year before really the whole Bullet Club takeover would really start happening. But, like, the Red Dragon at this time, especially against, like, the American Wolves, that was a pretty special match. And, you know, I mean, this was a – when you look at, like, how things are and how – things have been in the post-Coronet area, we're starting to see a lot of things kind of congeal in a way. I mean, I don't think Mike Mondo will be much longer in Ring of Honor, to be clear about that, talking about Coronet changes.
Yeah, Mondo, I know this is Shelton Benjamin's last weekend with a promotion. Mondo, when does he leave? Because he's in Ring of Honor through 2013. Okay, so he's there through September, but is on a part-time basis. He's actually really only working... He only works Northeast shows at this point, so New York and Philadelphia, yeah. And then he's gone. And I will defend Mike Mondo. I always thought he was fine in Ring of Honor. I never understood why people hated No Fear Mike Mondo. I kind of thought he was an entertaining addition to the Sinclair era of Ring of Honor.
And it makes sense that in Northeast, I'm looking at him at this time. He is, other than being booked randomly in Florida, I know why that is. That's an arena sold show. But anyways, other than that, for the most part, he is not being booked outside the Northeast in Canada. So it made sense where he was. And I mean, really, to this day, when he has wrestled, he hasn't wrestled, I believe, since 2019. But he wrestles in the Northeast, or he wrestles in just random places that pops up there. I mean, did he faze me? Was I a huge fan of him? Not really. But did I really care about Mike Mondo? Not at all. No. No.
Dave says in The Observer that Ring of Honor set their all-time gate record with a sellout crowd of 1,800 fans. And he also says the biggest news out of this show was Jay Briscoe ending Kevin Steen's nearly one-year reign as champion. The bad news out of it was that the iPay-per-view which had no significant problems, did have issues right at the end of the main event. The screen froze for a few minutes, and when it came back on, Briscoe was hitting the J-Driller on Steen to win the title. They played the change-up for all it was worth with a major celebration in the ring with three generations worth of members of the Briscoe's family. The title loss was to set up Steen's final breakup from Scum and the babyface turn, which took place the next day. At the TV tapings, and ROH did offer everyone who purchased the show a $5 credit. A $5 credit for either merchandise or off the price of a future iPay-per-view because of the problem. So Ring of Honor still not totally nailing the PR aspect of iPay-per-view failures. And I remember watching this show live, I was trying to debate whether this was the first Ring of Honor iPay-per-view I watched or if it was the next one they had. But I remember watching the main event and not really seeing the finish and being a little bit confused about what happened. So Ring of Honor, you know, it's one step forward, two steps back with them, just like Evolve. And it's a frustrating time, really, for any independent outside of PWG at this point.
Yeah, I'd say PWG and Chikara at this point really kind of were at a stride. We will be talking this year about how Chikara takes this stride and kind of puts it right in the toilet. But it's something where the older guard of promotions are having serious issues. One of them would start getting it figured out, and then the other one, well, we'll talk about that for the next 9 episodes.
Yes, so with that in mind, before we get to Chikara, we have to talk about CZW real quick. CZW at WrestleCon. This took place on the same night as Evolve 19. Oh God, what a show. Let me just run down the results here. I have no notes on this show, but...
Neither do I.
Six-way aerial assault match with AR Fox defeating Chiva Kid, Lucky 13, Rich Swann, Shane Hollister, and Shane Strickland. Ultraviolet Rules, Joe Gacy, WWE superstar Joe Gacy, defeats Matt Tremont. There was an 8-man tag with Alexander James, Drew Gulak, Kimberly, and Mr. Tofiga defeating the front of Biff Busick, Eric Corvus, Nicholas Kay, and Niles Sozio. CZW tag team titles, Blackout defeats Dustin Reyes and Eric Ryan. Greg Excellent defeated Colt Cabana in a singles match. Danny Havoc and Drake Younger went to a no contest in an Ultraviolet Rules match. There was a tag team number one contendership match. Very interesting names in this one, not necessarily Oink of Dave and Jake Crist, but the Sumerian Death Squad of Michael Dante and Tommy End. I believe this is the only match that those two worked this weekend. They lose a CZW tag titles number one contendership match. Semi-main event, Sami Callihan defeats Brian Kendrick. And your main event, the barbed wire and gusset plate death match, Masada defeats Jun Kasai.
That's CZW, like, through and through. By the way, the front of Biff Busick, Eric Corvus, Nicholas Kay, and Sozio, that takes me back to a certain time and era.
Wow. Oh, God, yes. Just, I mean, Biff Busick in CZW, and his rise, we'll talk about him a little bit because he's on the final Dragon Gate USA shows, but there's not a direct correlation between Dragon Gate USA shutting down and Biff Busick's career taking off, but on the timeline, it does work out that way, where as soon as Dragon Gate USA is out of the picture, all of a sudden Biff Busick is like a guy on the independent scene, and, you know, the front is just Niles Sozio, a name I had blocked out of my memory. That one hit me pretty hard thinking about that. Mike, we also have, this took place the day after the show we're talking about, but next week we're talking about Dragon Gate proper in Japan. So we're going to give you the rundown of the Chikara Shoulder of Palace show, which took place at the WrestleCon venue. This was a show attended by over 1,200 people. And Mike, this is a good Chikara show. This is Saturine defeating Kobold in the opener. The Battery won a 4-way tag team elimination match.
The Battery, you mean?
What did I say? The Battery?
The Battery. This isn't a Pitcher, Catcher, or Metallica album. Or single. Whatever.
I was so upset by the throwbacks not winning that I butchered the names of the winners, because Dasher Hatfield and Mr. Touchdown were in that match, and they should have won. What I'm fascinated about is the 8-man tag team match with Fist of Chucky T, Icarus, Johnny Gargano, and Sugar Dunkerton defeating 3.0, Grand Akuma, and Marty Jannetty in an 8-man tag match. There was also Archibald Peck defeating Tim Dunst. Tim Donst, rather. Chikara names, they will continue to trip me up, and it doesn't get much better as there was an 8-man tag with Soldier Ant and the Colony Extreme Force, which was Arctic Rescue Ant, Missile Assault Ant, and Orbit Adventure Ant, defeating the Colony of Assailant, Fire Ant, Green Ant, and Frightmare. And then your final two matches, Eddie Kingston retains the Chikara Grand Title over Hollow Wicked. In your main event, Jushin Thunder Liger and Mike Quackenbush defeat Jigsaw and the Shard.
Yeah, this was supposed to be one of Quackenbush's retirement matches, which makes a whole lot of sense. And yeah, that this is like the Chikara shutdown we will probably talk about in 3 weeks' time. Or 4 or 5 weeks' time, according to, I forget when exactly it lines up with DGUSA, but we have the idea of, because this was right when I was like on the way out of Chikara at the time, because the idea was like they had like this new incompetent owner who like was, it was a whole pun off of Sabermetrics, and was like trying, was like messing up teams such as putting Sugar Dunkington and Team Fist, messing up all the ants, and then Jigsaw and the Shard starting to team each other as pieces of hate. Actually, a pretty fun little tag team, but just was, you know, it's interesting, like 1260 for this show, boy, things will turn around for Chikara real quick.
Oh, in a shocking degree. And the other thing that things will turn around for is NXT, and we have to end our timeline with WrestleMania access notes, and I will apologize up front. I think Mike and I blew this a little bit because I don't remember going in detail about the FCW change into NXT. Mike, did we cover this and I'm just forgetting it, or have we not mentioned that FCW is now NXT?
Well, we talked about it in 2012 when they proposed the idea about this, when Triple H kind of took that role.
Okay, fair. I do remember that now.
Yeah. So now it's fully NXT. I believe the show is still on Bright House. They haven't launched the network yet. We'll be talking about the network in 2014. That's a big topic that I constantly send Case notes of. And eventually he basically slaps my hand back and says, not yet, Mike. But we're right on the precipice of it. And, you know, like the big thing about Access is that they would have matches from people on the main roster and a lot of NXT, especially in 2013, which is real collection of matches and names here.
Yeah, I at this point, I'm watching NXT on a weekly basis, and I'm watching it through Hulu. So I was on the ground floor of Sami Zayn and Adrian Neville in their WWE careers, and this is a show where I think I have as much information from this WrestleMania access from Rob Naylor's Twitter account as I do anything else on the internet, because even with matches, just to run down the things that jumped out to me here, Adrian Neville and Sami Zayn, and this was the first weekend with Sami Zayn being Sami Zayn, unmasked in the WWE program with the scarf and the hat, if you remember that initial character. Adrian Neville and Sami Zayn defeat Eric Rowan and Luke Harper. Connor O'Brien defeats Oh Yeah Percy Watson, so you really see the old and the new NXT merging on one card. Bo Dallas defeated Curt Hawkins, Antonio Cesaro defeats Xavier Woods, Paige defeats Summer Rae, Emma defeats Audrey Marie. I know Audrey Marie was a name, but I don't know why. Cassius Ohno defeating Jake Carter. Neville pulled double duty. He ended up defeating Corey Graves in a victory for humanity in the semi-main event. And your WrestleMania access card was headlined by R-Truth defeating Heath Slater. But I felt this was worth mentioning just for the notion that this was the first time Sami Zayn was born. This was his first weekend, and you would think this would be a massive deal, but there's no write-ups on Access anywhere to be found.
And really, other than the weekends where they would have it, like the most recent New Orleans weekend, there really never has been. Like, Access has been treated like its own little, like, diversion that shouldn't be evaluated, but we, like, look at all these names in total, and it's just like a collection of people that is just kind of remarkable at this time that are all kind of wrestling together. And then you get some names that you'll never see from again, like Dante Dash.
So, Mike, that is the WrestleMania weekend timeline. We have covered every single show that happened on WrestleMania weekend 2013. Just to quickly transition into the Dragon Gate USA timeline of things before we talk about Open the Ultimate Gate 2013, I'm going to throw some things at you because there's not a ton in Gabe's news wires. It's all, it's unfortunately self-explanatory. The only confusing thing was the Evolve bracket. But other than that, you know, Gabe's not in a Supercell mode. There's no stable shootouts. There's one weird thing Gabe does that we'll talk about. But other than that, things are pretty simple. So I have to note up top that on January 11th of 2013, Trent Beretta was released from the WWE. He had been with them since 2007. Trent goes all the way back to FCW for sure. I think he spent some time in Deep South as well. Not. Cage Match isn't showing that, but I think he was in Deep South. But he is an early FCW guy and was there through the beginning of 2013 and then was let go. You know, he worked, his first independent match back was on the HLW Resurrection show, the Hart Legacy Wrestling show. It was Lucha Libre rules with Team Teddy Hart of Brian Cage, Kamikaze, not Kamikaze, but Kamikaze, Flip Kendrick, Pete Wilson, and Teddy Hart defeating Team Conan of Davey Boy Smith Jr., El Generico, Jack Evans, Samurai Del Sol, and Trent Beretta. That match exists. That match is out there somewhere. And that was Trent's intro back into the indie scene because he was an NYWC guy before signing with WWE. So Trent is released on January 11th. And then we get our first big block of matches on February 22nd with Johnny Gargano's open contract being signed by Shingo Takagi, Shima and AR Fox defending the United Gate titles against the Young Bucks, Akira Tozawa against Ricochet, Sammy Callahan against UHA Nation, Brian Kendrick against Rich Swann, and John Davis versus Samurai Del Sol, but that match does not happen. Del Sol was injured the night before, so we end up getting John Davis versus Trent. And then, Mike, the final note that I have is from March 6th, and this pertains both to today's show as well as next week's show, where Gabe writes, "Open the Dreamgate champion Shima has revealed his team for the six-man tag match at Mercury Rising on April 7th in Secaucus, New Jersey." Well, sort of, and that is Gabe's writing. Shima has announced and revealed his team for the six-man tag match. Well, sort of. Shima sent word that this year's six-man tag will be about showcasing the future of Dragon Gate. His first partner will be Eita, who has displayed tremendous potential so far, but is in desperate need of a win. He could solidify himself as one of today's new stars by capturing the fall in this match. Shima then stated that the third member of his trio would be a secret weapon who has never been in DGUSA before. He would not reveal anything past that. And then Gabe goes on to say that the Super Smash Brothers will be booked against Eita and Shima's secret weapon on Open the Ultimate Gate.
Come on, Gabe, call him Max. That's a lot better. You call him Max. You really should have called him Max.
I find it bizarre that they didn't just... what was the mystery here? It was I don't...
Everyone knew.
Yeah, I don't see the wow factor in not announcing then Tomahawk, soon to be Tomahawk TT, then T-Hawk. Man went by a lot of names, like Jay-Z, but I don't know why he wasn't announced at the start of this. Instead, he was brought in as the secret weapon, but we ended up getting what would soon become the legendary tag team of T-Hawk and Eita on this show against the Super Smash Brothers. That was announced on March 6th. And Mike, with all of that in mind, WrestleMania weekend 2013, some dorky notes from Gabe, and everything in between, I am ready for Open the Ultimate Gate 2013.
Yeah, let's get into it. So, as we said at the start, this was on April 6th from Secaucus, New Jersey at the Midlands Expo Center. Approximate attendance of about 1,000. I have not found a straight number for that. And we start off the show with Rich Swann versus Brian Kendrick. Rich Swann would win because of the live stream, which we have a Larry Zonka review of the showcase, and Larry went off about the stream not working about this, but we had Rich Swann won with a corkscrew enziguri on Brian Kendrick, and this was the debut, at least in Dragon Gate USA, of Rich Swann coming out to All Night Long and singing, and it was something that was like, wow, this got over a lot more fast than I thought it did.
Yeah, so I'm going to be referencing the PWG All-Star Weekend 9 cards throughout this entire show because I think PWG All-Star Weekend 9 is a ginormous weekend in maybe not indie wrestling history, but of this era, All-Star Weekend 9 was a huge deal because you had Trent debuting in PWG. You had Johnny Gargano, AR Fox, and Samurai Del Sol debuting in PWG, which we'll talk about a little bit later in the impact that that had. And you also, that is the show where in the preview on the YouTube gimmick, Mike, in the preview of one of the shows, they show the Reseda crowd doing the all night long thing. And that show happens 2 weeks before WrestleMania. The YouTube preview was out a few days after the show. So at this point, I'm assuming most people in the audience watched that PWG YouTube preview. They saw Rich Swann coming out to All Night Long. They do it again on Dragon Gate USA. And as I've said the entire time since he's been a part of the promotion, Rich Swann is super over and super talented. And I don't want to say he's underused. I don't know. This match is just a painful reminder that Brian Kendrick has always been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Because this is like an excellent TV match. I understand what Brian Kendrick is trying to do, but I don't want this type of match on a Dragon Gate USA show.
Yeah, like this was all incredibly proficient, and you're absolutely right. It did have the feeling of a TV match, but the one thing that this match reminded me of was how out of place Brian Kendrick has been basically for everything except for that Johnny Gargano angle on the last block of shows. Like, he was awkward and was part of some of the absolute worst stuff in Dragon Gate USA year one, and he's back here having a TV match that's probably a 2¾ star TV match against Rich Swann, who just outclasses him both charismatically. That's not a word, but we're going to go with it.
Charismatically.
There we go. I just mispronounced it. You know, there we go.
I called a Chikara team the wrong name yet again. It happens, Mike. You know, we've been doing these episodes for like 40 weeks in a row, and some of the names just blur together after a while.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. And it's just, you kind of come out and you see this match and you're like, okay, that's fine. You also get the sense that Gabe doesn't know what to do with Rich Swann right now, so he just lets him go out there, pop the crowd and get out, and he's kind of forgotten about for the rest of the show.
I just think Kendrick is one of those guys that if he was an ECW, oh my God, I think we would look at Brian Kendrick's career entirely differently. Or even if he was either 10 years too late or 20 years too early, because I think now if Kendrick comes on the independent scene, his style is just so much more apt for WWE TV in 2021 rather than WWE TV in 2005, 2006. And I love his tag team with Paul London, but that was an undercard act on SmackDown in 2006. That is like an upper mid-card act in 2021. And it's just frustrating to see Kendrick in a spot where, you know, I don't even have a problem with this match being on the show. I do have a problem with this match opening up the show, this limb work, slow plotting match that kind of rips Rich Swann away from doing what he does best. I think it was a questionable opener, and as Mike said earlier, a 2¾ star match.
Yeah, and then afterwards, we had Chuck Taylor come out, and he said, I saw your, and I'm quoting verbatim, artistic or autistic promos, Chuck, 2013. I'm glad that Chuck's finally kind of realized what you should or shouldn't say, but took him a while.
Chuck is a guy that has evolved with the times.
That's very much for sure. And then he calls Kendrick out for claiming that Gentleman's Club is pissing away talent. He said that if you want to talk about pissing away talent, you've pissed away talent, Brian Kendrick. And they say they'll find out tomorrow. Then Chuck a segue into the next match, as he said, y'all remember the Chuck Taylor Invitational last year? Yes, we do, Chuck, very well. And then we had the six-way freestyle match. It had Shane Strickland, Chuck Taylor, Tony Nese, Eric Cannon, Jigsaw, and Fire Ant. The fall was Tony Nese with a 450 splash on Shane Strickland. And this is a discordant match that I ended up liking a whole lot.
Yeah, so a few things to note here. One, on Evolve 19, it was announced that Tony Nese had signed a contract with WWN. So he is a full-time player from here on out. I also have in my notes, quote, Fire Ant is disgustingly over. I can't believe it. Like, these Chikara guys are legends right now. They are the hottest thing that isn't Akira Tozawa or Shingo on this show. It's Jigsaw and Fire Ant are like the next two most over guys. And as a result, I think Fire Ant kind of killed it in this match. He does a crazy dive to the floor at one point, and all of his interactions are right on the money. I mean, he's a, you know, just whatever Fire Ant has become now, which if you don't know, I'll leave it up to your imagination. Like, I'm more annoyed by Fire Ant's current place in wrestling, not because I don't like that character, but I just think he's so much more talented than that.
And that's like always been the crux about the person who is Fire Ant, is like, even when he was debuting, like after he got like a year experience, he became like one of those really must-watch people in Chikara, and that was about 7 years previous to this. And we got to acknowledge, like, this guy, he's not coming close to my GWE 100 list, but he is probably one of the, I would say, 50 best North American wrestlers of the last decade, maybe, just because, like, he is so over and he gets such crowd connection with a full face mask and doesn't, and never talks, ever, and he's incredible.
Yeah, it's really impressive just to see just the level of talent in this match, because, you know, Chuck Taylor is always strong in settings like this. Jigsaw, Fire Ant, they're great. Anthony Nese is really rounding into his own at this time period, and I'm very curious to watch Nese for the last year of the promotion to see if he improves or not, because the last time we saw him was
2011,
yeah, because he's not on the final show in 2012. I was trying to remember if he was or not, but he's not. So the last time we saw him was spring of 2011, and his body is better, his look is better, and he is just a better wrestler in the year and a half since we've last seen him. The only guys out of place here are Eric Cannon, who I think does his job. He's kind of the brawler in this group of flyers, and he does that well. And then Shane Strickland, who I have always been hot and cold on. I will say his final run with Gabe, where was Shane Strickland an Evolve champion at one point?
I'm fairly certain he was. And that tells you like how things got with Gabe. The fact that we can't remember off our top of our head was so-and-so an Evolve champion.
Yeah, Shane Strickland was an Evolve champion. And that was the first time where Strickland had really connected with Gabe, because Gabe tries to bring him in here, and I would go as far to say Strickland is actively bad in this match, because he's
terrible.
He's really bad. I mean, he's really rough around the edges. And I don't know how many people remember this, but in 2015, one of the things that Evolve was trying to promote was like these wrestler sponsorships or mentorships, rather, where Johnny Gargano would vouch for Ethan Page. And so Ethan Page was like Johnny Gargano's young boy, and Rich Swann brought in Shane Strickland. And just to use those two as an example, you know, Ethan Page, for whatever he has to say about Gabe Sapolsky, and some of it I agree with, some of it I don't, Page ended up having a very successful Evolve career. Shane Strickland flamed out really quickly, and it wasn't until that third time that Gabe tried to use him that Strickland ended up working out. So Strickland was a disappointment here, but I think everyone else in this match accomplished the goal of just doing crazy shit and getting this crowd into it. I went 3.5 stars on this.
Yeah, I had the exact same rating. Like, working against like Shane Strickland, who just looked like he was out of his depth here. Like, that's what this was. Like, there's a point where he botched two dives in a row, where you're just like, okay, just not ready for this kind of moment. And Shane Strickland's someone that, like, I've watched like his Defy run and where things, and then Lucha Underground, where things really came together for him. It's just like, this was, I don't want to say too early, because I feel like that says that he wasn't experienced enough to do this. It just was, he had a bad night, and it became very clear that he was out of his depth here.
Yeah, and it I think was especially noticeable, just because if Nese was where he was in 2011, I don't know if the gap between the fifth best guy in this match and Strickland, who had been the sixth best guy in this match, I don't know if that gap is as wide, but because everyone played their role so well with the exception of Strickland, I think he looked much worse off because of it.
Yeah, and you talk about Nese. Nese comes off like a total god in this match. Like you could tell, like, at this point that, all right, no wonder Gabe signed this guy and waited 2 years, because he looks completely different. He is fully formed Tony Nese in a lot of ways. And one of my favorite moves that I saw this whole entire weekend, it's his running boot in the corner that just always looks brutal as hell. And that this match had five people playing their part and one person who wasn't able to keep up their end of the bargain. I think like that's probably the best way to put it. Anything else before we move on?
What was your star rating on this?
3.5/2.
Okay, right on the money so far.
And then we had Derek Rise versus Scott Reed with Larry Dallas. Scott Reed won with a smash mouth in 3 minutes and 13 seconds. And Case, this is really superfluous match. Like, this really was something that then we might as well talk about what happened afterwards, where the big thing on commentary that they said was that Connolly had the night off. Connolly came in, got into Larry Dallas's face and quit the scene, tries to get Reed to go with him, but then Reed attacks him. Marty Bell comes out for the save, and then both her and Caleb Connolly lay out Larry Dallas, and suddenly Caleb Connolly is crazy over at the end of this like 10-minute segment and match.
I will say the breakup of the scene did more for Caleb Connolly and Scott Reed than anything else that had been booked for them up to this point, because I thought the Derek Rice squash match made Scott Reed look awesome. And there's specifically one moment where Derek Rise is like on all fours doubled over. I think Scott Reed had just done a big power move, and Rise is trying to sell it. And Reed hits the ropes and kicks this man in the stomach. And that is, it is the biggest high spot of the match, because it might have been a shoot kick to the stomach, because Derek Rise lets out this like, oh, and Reed, you know, gloats because of it. It is a tremendous, tremendous spot between those two that it was nothing in the match, because a lot of it was Scott Reed doing power moves. And then Caleb Connolly comes out and gets this big reaction, and he breaks up with the scene, which I think the crowd was perhaps less excited that Caleb Connolly was going face, and rather just more excited that they wouldn't have to watch the scene anymore. But it ends up being this great angle where I think everyone comes out better for it. Larry Dallas does his job and he gets beat up by Caleb Connolly and Marty Bell. And from the little bit of Marty Bell that we've seen, it's a very low bar to clear, but I think this was the most effectively she was used. It's weird, but this was a really good segment.
I just felt like that on a show this long, like it was effective. But I was pretty much like, all right, let's get to the good stuff. So, like, it was effective. Don't get me wrong here. But I kind of came around like, this was already a show that on the third match that we've had, one just match that was there and one match that was flawed but good. We had, like, this, like, 15-minute thing, and then leading into, like, the next segment, the next match. It just kind of, this for me was, like, an absolute low point of the card that I was just trying to get through. Like, it was effective. Don't get me wrong. But it just felt like this was happening, and then we had the rest of a Mania weekend show.
Yeah, I think this segment would have come across better had Chuck Taylor and Brian Kendrick not cut promos with one another at the end of the opening match, because this show really straddles that fine line of match angle, match angle, match angle, which is a formula that Gabe really falls into, especially in the last year of Dragon Gate USA. We're just about to hit this point where it was a big complaint of the Young Bucks when they ended up leaving Gabe to go to New Japan and Ring of Honor, was that all of Gabe's shows were match, promo, angle, promo, match, angle, angle, promo, match. It was just this very formulaic, and not in a pleasing way. It wasn't a well-oiled machine. It was this rusty, a noisy, rickety machine of Gabe Sapolsky booking in 2013. But I think the scene angle worked. Now, I also think if you do this angle in Everett, Massachusetts, or in Taylor, Michigan, it probably dies a little bit of a death. But because it happened in front of this Evolve crowd, or I'm sorry, this Dragon Gate USA crowd, in front of the largest crowd in their history, a hot crowd at that, I think it came off pretty well.
Yeah, like this is the right time to do it. It just felt like between like this first half of the show, with the exception of the six-way, really I was like, this does not feel like a big show. This felt like it was like a storyline thing, and then things picked up, but it'll be a little bit before we get to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we get into the next match. Trent defeats John Davis by DQ in 12 minutes and 20 seconds. Davis got DQ'd for not breaking the 5 count in a corner after punch with headbutts. It just was, yeah. I mean, John Davis. We still have John Davis in this gimmick that's completely killed him dead, and Trent is fine here. Like, this is all effective and well worked, but now there's like a black hole around John Davis that completely has removed most of any enthusiasm I've built with towards him in this project.
So let me play you some alternate timeline stuff real quick as to what could have happened. And this is all stuff that was slated to happen at one point, but for a variety of reasons didn't, and how it not only reshaped this weekend, but just reshaped just the immediate future of Dragon Gate USA. So I referenced PWG All-Star Weekend 9 earlier, and those are shows that took place in the middle of March. And like I said, it was the debut in the promotion for Johnny Gargano, AR Fox, Samurai Del Sol, and Trent. And if people have seen those shows at this point, they know that on night one, it was Trent wrestling Roderick Strong. And then the match that people came away talking about that weekend was Rich Swann and Ricochet against AR Fox and Samurai Del Sol. That match was supposed to be the Super Smash Brothers and Samurai Del Sol against Rich Swann, Ricochet, and AR Fox. But Super Smash Brothers had some issues. I don't know if this was an issue they had at the border or if they were injured. I honestly do not know, and I could not figure out an answer. All I know is that that six-man was changed to a tag team match. The reason I bring that up is I am someone at this point, like I said, I watched the Ring of Honor show from this weekend live. At this point, I am following Ring of Honor, and I am not only following PWG, I am pre-ordering the DVDs the day they are available. I am obsessed with PWG at this point in my life. I think I'm in eighth grade when this show is released. I was about to go into high school, and I am utterly obsessed with every single thing PWG. I was not aware of Johnny Gargano, AR Fox, or Samurai Del Sol until I watched All-Star Weekend 9, which is incredibly troubling for Dragon Gate USA because Johnny Gargano had been their champion for 18 months at this point, almost 18 months, and AR Fox and Samurai Del Sol were two guys that they had built the scope of their promotion around, and I did not know them until they came to PWG and they blew the roof off of Reseda. That AR Fox and Del Sol versus Rich Swann and Ricochet tag match is unbelievable. Samurai Del Sol would have been signed anyways, but I would like to think that that PWG weekend and the buzz off of him coming out of that was like, oh my god, we need this guy right now. He could be the next Rey Mysterio. It sounds insane given the 7 or 8 years we've seen of Kalisto, but in the scope of spring and summer 2013, I don't think it's that wild. So I mentioned this because Samurai Del Sol is supposed to be in this match. It's supposed to be John Davis versus Samurai Del Sol. They wrestled on an FIP show in, I believe, March of 2013. I have not seen the match, but they wanted to do the rematch here, and they wanted to give Samurai Del Sol a big spot against the heel knockout king-esque John Davis, even though this gimmick is dying a horrible, painful death. And instead, we get Trent in this spot instead. Trent was not one of those guys that was like an indie darling. He was a New York Wrestling Connection guy who I don't know how he got signed when he did as Plasma.
He got signed so young. He was like 18.
So young and like, again, not a name, not somebody that Gabe was like looking to bring in at any point in the immediate future in 2007 Ring of Honor, but Trent gets signed. But I think through like Colt Cabana always sung Trent's praises, and then you have that bubble of like, oh, like Curt Hawkins and Zack Ryder really like this guy. So Trent acclimated himself to the scene very well, but if you look at Trent's debut matches in PWG, it's him against Roddy and then him against Paul London, and they're both okay matches. I think the Roddy one's a little bit better, but it is very clear that Trent, like Drew Galloway, was one of those guys that it took him a few months to shake off of the WWE system, and I think Trent ends up getting good. I think we'll see good Trent Beretta matches in Dragon Gate USA. I think he figures it out pretty quickly, but he hadn't totally figured it out yet. So you're dealing with Trent in limbo against John Davis, who is doing this knockout thing that is not over. Davis gets DQ'd in this match for doing too many headbutts, DQ'd for kicking too much ass, as Brian and Vinny would say. And I have to say, I think this is one of the worst matches in Dragon Gate USA history.
You see, I felt like I was being charitable with 2.25 stars. I want to hear how much you hated this thing, because I know I have hated some things a lot more strongly than you're sounding right now. Is this a sub 1-star match for you?
Yes, I gave it a half star. And I want to be clear. I think I hated this match for what it represented more than for the actual work, because in a bubble, in a vacuum, Trent was not bad and John Davis was not bad. Now, I do think at this point they had negative chemistry with one another. They individually were fine, but I did not think the match was any good. I thought they were clunky, thought it was awkward, didn't think the crowd cared. And then Davis does these headbutts that it's not Shibata headbutting somebody and the blood coming down his face. These were like worked headbutts that didn't look any good. And that's what they called the DQ on. And I might have even gone lower on this had I not loved the post-match segment, which made me upset because it was like, that's what John Davis could be. Like, John Davis is so horribly miscast and has been for basically a year at this point. Everything post-Miami, John Davis has been just murdered by the booking. And it's so frustrating.
All right, Case, I'm going to run 2 matches by you, and I want you to tell me if this match, in your opinion, was better or worse than.
Okay.
First off, Mercury Rising 2012, Street Fight, Sabu versus Sami Callihan.
I would rather watch Sabu versus Sami Callihan because that match is fun bad, but Davis-Trent is the better wrestling match of the two.
Okay. All right. Then we have, as I'm flipping through my notebook, because I'm trying to get the exact name of this match right here and the exact participants here. Where is it?
I know there's one match for sure that I think is worse than this.
Here we go. Hardcore match, Mercury Rising 2010, March 27th, 2010. Hardcore, John Moxley versus Tommy Dreamer.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. That's the one you brought up. That's not what I thought you were going to.
Oh, what you thought I was going to bring up?
Moxley versus Homicide, which is the worst match in Dragon Gate USA history. That Moxley versus Homicide match where Homicide pins.
Oh, right, yeah.
Homicide has Moxley pin him. It's literally a Russo-esque finish. No, the Moxley versus Dreamer match isn't any good, but it's also Tommy Dreamer, so I don't care. I don't have an emotional attachment to it other than the fact that I want Tommy Dreamer off of my screen. This is John Davis, who I still like want him to be rehabbed at this point. I this match was fine, but the finish was so bad. I couldn't handle it.
Okay, so yeah. Moxley versus Homicide and Sabu versus Sami Callihan are my 2 duds so far in this series. So those are matches I think are, I just can't stand those matches.
Was Moxley versus Homicide on United Finale? Is that show?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that is the worst match I've seen so far.
Okay, that's fair. And then let's talk about this post-match promo, which actually came across really strong, and actually Davis kind of attempting to turn this bad gimmick around, where John Davis attacks both Trent and the referee, Brett Lauderdale. That's a name right there, Brett Lauderdale. And he grabs the mic, runs down the crowd, and he issues an open challenge. The crowd chanted Super Dragon, which he ignored. And then Hogan, who he lit up on the microphone. And John Davis, if he was doing this rather than staring at people, I'd be like, all right, John Davis is a monster. This rules. But no, there was a guy who was, they had the iPhone timer guy was in the front row again. And he stood on him for like a full minute. And then he does something really awesome in the post-match.
Yeah, I thought John Davis cut an excellent promo here, challenging anybody, and nobody answered, and it weirdly made John Davis look really tough that no one came out and answered his challenge. But it's just like, at this point, for as much as I like John Davis, I don't want him on these shows. His character is just frustrating at this point. It's unbelievable.
Goods.
That's exactly what he is. It's so upsetting, and it is just such a steep decline from the end of 2011, where he's launching Pinky Sanchez into the entranceway of the ECW arena, and this guy looks like Goldberg all of a sudden, and then 2012, things just go wrong, and I would really like to talk to Gabe about what his vision was for John Davis, because it just feels really muddy, and like I said a few weeks ago, The staring gimmick, I just want to know what the ideal reaction for it was. I just want to know, in your best case scenario, in front of your hottest crowd, in front of your most loyal fan base, what is the end result of that staring gimmick?
Yeah, no. There's a lot of questions there, because it is clear after this angle that Davis can work as a heel wrestler and he'd be cutting heel promos and he comes off like a badass, but you have him staring at people. You have all the stuff that with Johnny Gargano that happens at Evolve that's supposed to be a part of the canon but is only either obliquely referred to or played once in a promo package. Like, there's a lot. I'm really wondering what was going through Gibbs Polsky's head with this character.
Yeah, it's very confusing and very unfortunate.
Luckily, Case, I have something for you that's not confusing or unfortunate. It is Ada and Tomahawk TNE defeating the Super Smash Brothers of Player Dos and Player Uno when Tomahawk hits the Night Ride on Stu in 14 minutes and 23 seconds. And boy, TNE had instant chemistry in it, and of course they should have. They've been in Mexico for the last month, and they worked really well with Super Smash Brothers, and I adore this match.
Yeah, this is awesome. I think I remember liking this match a little bit more the times I had seen this. And I should mention, this is a show. These two shows, Open the Ultimate Gate 2013 and Mercury Rising 2013, are the last Dragon Gate USA DVDs that were ever released. The last year of the promotion from Bushido Code of the Warrior through Mercury Rising 2014 are not on DVD. But I had these two shows on DVD, so I've seen this show, you know, close to a dozen times at this point, because I really like some of the matches here. I think I remember liking this match a little bit more, but ultimately it is just one of those things where the Super Smash Brothers were so hot and so over at this time, and I do have to give some credit to Gabe, because he has the Super Smash Brothers go over against the Young Bucks the night before, and even though they lose in this match, they look really, really strong against Dragon Gate guys, which means more than looking really strong against US Indie guys and then losing. And then, you know, we'll talk about the next show when we get to it, but Gabe very clearly rallies around the Super Smash Brothers as a team to push, but this is the last time we ever see them, because they have their border issues immediately after this show ends. So it's disappointing from that aspect, but this match rocks. I went 3 3/4 on it. And Mike, this is going to sound like a gimmick question, like it's one that I'm asking in bad faith, but I really want you to think about it and
okay. And
answer it, which is this the most over T-Hawk has ever been in a single night? And let me explain, because he comes in as the secret weapon. He gets a nice little pop when he comes out, but his chops get so over immediately, because he chops Player Uno and it just about kills him. And then, you know, it's from there, it's a T-Hawk and Ata tag match, which is a formula that worked time after time after time. And I was just recently looking through some stuff, and I kind of forgot just how many great matches they had. Like, you can point to the Shingo and Tozawa match at Kobe World 2014 as arguably the peak of their style, but there are so many T-Hawk and Ata matches that were just, you know, Hakata Star Lane shows or Kobe Sambo Hall shows. Those guys wrestled as a two-on-two team all the time, and all of those matches were good, and this is the first one of their career that they really deliver on. But this crowd has no ill will towards T-Hawk. He hasn't failed them yet. He's done nothing wrong. He just got super over with the chops, and it might be the most positive response he has ever gotten in a single match.
Yeah, and I think this is, like, it's something where there probably is one of these simulations or string universes where T-Hawk goes to the United States more. And I think he would work infinitely better, Case, as an American indie wrestler, especially, like, him with, like, Busick and him versus Drew Gulak and like that era of Evolve, I feel like that he would have been very, very effective in like the last 5 years of the Indies versus how his native response has always been in Japan. Because you do have that wasn't exactly a curse question you asked me. I think that's a fair statement, because the chops were crazy over. They busted out the Doomsday Lung Blower, and they've done it much more since then. I don't think that this pairing hit a better Doomsday Lung Blower than in this match. It just looked insane. And yeah, T-Hawk was super, got over just doing little things, and it translates very well, and it's not dissimilar to how Akira Tozawa first got over through charisma. So I think that this is one of the most positive responses that T-Hawk gets, with the exception of maybe him winning the cage match and shaving Shima's head, I would say.
Yeah, that's one I hadn't thought about. That's a fair assumption, though. And it's another one of those. I mean, this is a big alternate timeline show of just what could have happened, because you can ask yourself, you know, what if T-Hawk stays in America and somehow T-Hawk, this Dragon Gate import, is a better fit in the Roderick Strong, Timothy Thatcher, Biff Busick era of Evolve, and I think he would have killed
fight
it there. But T-Hawk's fight pit. And then you also kind of have to ask yourself, you know, what if Super Smash Brothers had gone to Japan? And I don't think that was ever a legitimate possibility, but it was one that, you know, they kind of killed it in Dragon Gate USA when they wrestled the Japanese guys, and it just would have been an interesting thing to see. I think they would have gotten over there. I think they would have done well. And this match just has me asking a lot of questions.
Super Smash Brothers and Dragon Gate. I don't know.
I think it comes down to, if Uno could have gotten in really good shape, I think that could have worked. It is a matter of, can Uno keep up working that style 4 to 5 days a week, and whether he wanted to or not? Because I think we saw, you know, Kevin Steen, when he did that tour in 2006, was roughly Uno's size. It just so happens they also come from the same part of the world, so that worked out nicely. But by the end of the tour, you know, Steen's not a bad wrestler. He's fitting in Dragon Gate perfectly fine. He just didn't like being in Japan, wrestling that style as often as he was, you know. I'm not going to say working as hard as he had to, but just working that style so often, it was really hard on him. And I think that is the big asterisk there. But from an in-ring standpoint, I do think they would have fit in just fine.
No, I think that's a fair assessment. I went 4.25 on this case. This was exactly like what I was hoping out of this weekend. This felt like we talked about the first era of the WrestleMania weekends from 2010 to this point. This felt like a big WrestleMania weekend match, because if you put it on like a show 2 years from then, you bring in the Dragon Gate guys, T-Hawk and Ada versus Super Smash Brothers, it's not going to sell you a whole ton tickets, but that's the kind of match you put on these shows, and I think it overwhelmingly delivered in that. And then you've made me think a lot about T-Hawk in America because of this.
Yeah, is T-Hawk the Brian Kendrick of the Dragon Gate universe, where he was always in the wrong place at the wrong time? Because look, once T-Hawk left Dragon Gate, it worked out for him. That run as Wrestle 1 champion was awesome.
Yep. And then we get into Ricochet versus Akira Tozawa. Ricochet defeats Akira Tozawa in 19 minutes and 55 seconds with the 630 splash. And boy, did they just... They decided to move Reseda out to Secaucus, New Jersey with this one, Case.
Mike, like I said, I've seen this show numerous times at this point. I've seen this match before. I knew I liked this match. I had no idea how much I loved this match until this most recent viewing. I lost my mind. This is one of the best matches we've watched in this series, and I had never ever thought of it as that level of being good. I probably had it right around 4 stars, 4.25 maybe, but I'll let you know right now, I went 4.75 on this. This was unbelievable, and part of it is the crowd. Part of it is the fact that, look, it's Tozawa and Ricochet. They can't do anything wrong, especially at this point in their career. I also just think it's interesting. One, this is the first time they ever wrestled in a singles match. And I know they end up wrestling each other in PWG a few years down the road. They wrestle each other in Dragon Gate UK as well. I don't think this singles match ever happened in Japan, which is a mistake. I know they were in the same unit for pretty much their entire time, with the exception of this moment where Tozawa's and Matt Blanky and Ricochet's in World 1 International, I would have shoehorned this onto some show somehow, because these guys have such ridiculous chemistry with one another. But we just saw Ricochet in December of 2012 and just noted how good he was, how he had become such a well-rounded performer. He had improved so much since we first saw him. And he comes out here, and Mike, he's 10 times as better. This is like an all-time great Ricochet performance, because he does every little thing in this match so well.
Yeah, and it's also like the special time, special place, because the crowd goes insane for this match. There was an axe kick that this crowd popped more for than things that would happen in the Young Bucks AR Fox Shima match. Just insane stuff. These two guys, as you said, I would have thrown them together in a King of Gate in that year and a half period where they were apart before, because Monster Express would be forming before the end of DGUSA, so that wouldn't happen there. Like, that seems like that would have been like a no-brainer there, but these two guys rock. Their chemistry is, like, some people are just like, they just work well together. It's a shame that we didn't get more of this. And then one of the things that really got me was when Ricochet was going for the handspring Poison Rana, and then Tozawa pulled him down right into his German suplex rush that goes into the finish. I thought that was truly exceptional. This is a match worth going out of your way for. I went 4.5. You're 4.75. That's not unrequited. It deserves that. This was my match of the night. I thought this was truly exceptional.
I couldn't believe it, because again, like, I always liked this match, but it was never one that really jumped out at me. And I don't think there was a turning point in this match, because it was great. From bell to bell, there was no real dead portion in this match. The one spot that made me almost jump off my couch was Ricochet gets hit with a backdrop driver, and then he comes back and nudges Tozawa in the stomach, and then hits an axe kick to the back of Tozawa's head. That just, oh my god, it looked so violent. Like, that's BB Hulk's move, and Hulk has never done one that good. Like, Ricochet completely stole his thunder. But I just thought everything about this was great. You know, Tozawa ended up kicking out of the backslide driver, and then was eventually beat with the 630. This is worth a price of admission. Forget the last two matches on the show, the six-way that was fun, whatever else. This would have made the entire weekend worth it. This was a special, special match.
Yeah. This is going to be a match that's going to be very hard for the rest of 2013 to reach up to. Like, it is that special of a match. Next match, UHA Nation making his DGUSA return, defeating Sami Callihan in 16 minutes and 17 seconds with the UHA combination. And I just want you to get your thoughts out first, Case, because I thought that this was an interesting match, and I don't know how you came away with it.
Interesting is not the word I would use to describe this. I would actually describe it as the exact opposite. If the finish to John Davis versus Trent wasn't so bad, this would have easily been my worst match of the night. I hated this. It was so slow and so long, and it was just, you know, this is Callahan's last weekend in the promotion, and I get the sense that Gabe knew that, or at least had an idea, because Callahan is signed by the Florida Evolve shows, where that's Samurai Del Sol's last weekend, but Callahan is not on those shows. He wraps up here. And if you're going to have UHA come back, I'm not saying he has to squash Callihan like a bug, but 16 minutes of limb work between UHA Nation and Sami Callihan was not exactly what I was looking forward to. I hated this match.
You see, unlike you, who is offering me a question in good faith about T-Hawk, no, this match was weird. I said interesting in a bad way. Yeah, UHA tries to do like his power moves, but Sami is like working his knee the entire time. It's something that just kind of comes off forced and awkward. It goes on incredibly long, where like I did not know that I forgot that Sami was gone by the next time. Like, he is wrapping up, but 16 minutes for that just did not really work. It was deliberate, but it kind of just, this was the first match after intermission. Doing a deliberate match right after intermission seems like a real bad idea. And I went 2.5 stars on this, and that's mainly because it was good to see UHA back. It's good to see UHA back in good shape and not having any knee problems, but it just weird. Like, this is not really a match that, and this is a match that, with the exception of this, I have four matches I went 4 stars or higher on. like to finish out the show, like this match is just the outlier that felt like it probably should have gone on before the T-Hawk and Ada versus Super Smash Brothers match.
Yes, I think that's a great point. If you come back from intermission with SSB versus T-Hawk and Ada, you run into a point, if let's say the cards are the exact same, the results are the exact same, but you have Callahan and Uha switching with that, you do run into the issue of going from Davis versus Trent to Callahan versus Uha. That might have killed the crowd completely to the point of no return, but I agree. This match was just bad. And I think there's a segment of the population, and I don't want to speak for them because I don't know the majority or the minority's opinion on this match. I know TJ Hawk hated it in his review. It was very funny to me, his review there. But I think there's a crowd of people that are especially pro Sami Callihan, that like what he does, that like the intricacies of his work, way more so than they like the white trash MMA side of Sami, that I could see them trying to fight for this match and say, no, this is actually very good. Look at the way look at the way he worked the leg. Look at the way that it was sold. But I don't even think it's a technically proficient match. I just think this one was really boring on a show that just, I don't remember the show being this unbalanced. I will say that. Like, it is match of the year contender stuff mixed in with like star and a quarter stuff.
Yeah, like that's kind of what it goes down to, is like, it's a real like dichotomy of a show. And I think that because the match that went to intermission was Akira Tozawa and Ricochet, I think that this would have been fine before that match because the crowd was going to care about those two regardless. Like, basically, I'm just hiding that match before that one and moving a much better match to bring the crowd back into the show.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And then we go into the first of the two title matches, Open the United Gate, Air Fox and Shima. They fail in this defense. The Young Bucks' claims have come true. They finally have, after months of taunting them and wanting to have Air Fox and Shima, they defeat them. They pin Air Fox with more bang for your buck. And only 19 minutes and 29 seconds. This match felt a lot longer. Okay, so what were your thoughts?
I love this match. I think this is probably one of, and it won't register this way when I say it, but let me explain. I think this is probably one of the more important Young Bucks matches in the history of their career. Because throughout, let's just use the Dragon Gate USA timeline, where they come in and, you know, they wrestle Shima and Yokosuka on the first show, and they're not the future, they're the now, and they're pushed as this hot act. And it all seems to be building to the Young Bucks versus Speed Muscle and Phoenix, but we don't get those matches for a number of reasons. So the Bucks leave after WrestleMania weekend 2010. They go to TNA. They're never used, right? They're Generation Me. They're Max and Jeremy Buck. They're this and they're that. They come back to Ring of Honor in the summer of 2011, and people think, okay, well, they figured it out now. You know, they're going to be PWG Young Bucks and Ring of Honor, and it's going to be great. It's going to be exactly what Sinclair needs. And instead, they run into issues with Jim Cornette and the booking, and they're not used right, and the Ring of Honor office doesn't like them, and whatever. So they're out of Ring of Honor, and then they, you know, they're at this point where they're close to walking away from wrestling at the start of 2013. And we talked about that during the SoCal Triple Shot, was, you know, yes, they're still killing it in PWG, but they are at a career rock bottom at this point. And it is Gabe bringing them back into the fold. I think they have two very good matches in Southern California, and one match that I think Mike liked more than I did. I wasn't too crazy on the DUF match. And then they come in here and, you know, this just was the match they need to have, a big win in a great match in front of a big audience, because it's not like they hadn't worked big shows for Ring of Honor in the past 18 months, but they weren't doing this. They weren't putting on a four-star match like this was in front of those Ring of Honor crowds, and they certainly weren't winning the Ring of Honor tag team titles. Now, you know, what difference in the grand scheme of things do winning the Open the United Gate titles make? Probably not a ton, but it was just a necessary win for the Young Bucks at this point in their career. They always had great chemistry with Shima. They always, always, always had great chemistry with AR Fox. I think it's disappointing those two actually didn't wrestle more often between Fox and the Young Bucks, because I think they bring out the best in one another, because they bring an element of danger when they wrestle one another, and that was present in this match. And I think this is like a real turning point in the Young Bucks' career. It gives them a home. It gives them a title. It gives them something to do outside of PWG, and they desperately needed that at this point in their career.
Yeah, and it's funny that you bring that all up, Case, about the Bucks needing this. I recently finished the Bucks book, and they don't talk too much about DGUSA other than Gabe as someone taking a chance on them, and then eventually they moved along, and they went to places that they were starting to have kids and they needed to have the money. But upon their return to DGUSA, there's really only like three paragraphs about it, and it's all about this match. So they recognize how important this match was, and it's something where like the true star in this match weren't the Young Bucks, it weren't Seema, it was Air Fox, because you have Air Fox now, who's already had an insane weekend, and Lenny Leonard does a great job of getting that over, deciding for like the first like 6 minutes just to take all the heat. Take all the heat, and he gets like the big comeback. There's that 450 onto Shima's knees that he does on, I think it was against Matt, that looks absolutely insane. And it comes together to tell like this, both like this conquering like thing of like, we said we will do this and then we did it. And then you have the fact that Air Fox in a lot of ways really matured over this weekend. He is now the Evolve champion. He doesn't really need to be around Shima. And this might be the most superfluous that I think Shima has felt like in Dragon Gate USA, because he's more just taken for the ride. He's not dropping the fall here, and he's good in this match, but it's really a story of the other three guys here.
Air Fox really worked the prototype WrestleMania weekend schedule this weekend, because he works the three matches in Evolve the night before and then has the one here, and then he is in the ladder match the next night, so it's five matches in 3 days for AR Fox. He might have been on that CZW show as well. So AR Fox was just all over the place, and the fact that he was able to pull out what, again, I thought was a legitimately great match between he and the Young Bucks is very, very impressive.
Yeah, and the crowd got back up after the really weird, bad UHA Sammy match. I went 4.25 on this. I thought that this was another strong match on the show.
I am right at 4, but I can't knock you for going that quarter star higher.
And then, Case, we get into the main event. Probably the last famous match of Dragon Gate USA. It is Johnny Gargano versus Shingo Takagi. He defeats Shingo Takagi by referee's decision, having a ref stoppage due to a Gargano escape that is using the rope in his waistband, to tap him out after getting a low blow. There's two ref bumps in 33 minutes and 20 seconds. And now we have the moment that we kind of are speculating, like, is this going to feel like the moment that Johnny Gargano really does take the step up and becomes what Gabe Sapolsky has positioned him for a long time? And Case, do you think this happened in this match?
I think so. I don't know what the consensus on this finish is, but I will say this. I think this match, which is one that I've always held in really high regard, I think it is perhaps the best Gargano performance of all time. Maybe some of the NXT matches at this point have him beat, some of the good NXT matches with DIY against the Revival, not the Gargano versus Cole and Gargano versus Ciampa stuff. But I've always looked at this match as something that was near perfection, and I've always defended the finish on a number of levels. Let me talk about the match real quick, which I think it can be summarized not by any of the words I say, but if you watch this match and look in the lower right-hand corner of the screen when Shingo hits Johnny Gargano with a straight right hand towards the end of the match, you can see the timekeeper, Dr. Keith Lipinski, his jaw drops, and Lipinski looks like he's in a trance watching this match, and it is the perfect summarization of what this is, because it starts really slow, it takes a while to get going, it almost has that classic Dreamgate structure, but once things hit, they are on such another level. And this is the Gargano, this is the output that I expected from him in 2012 that I did not get. And it just so happens that Shingo, who the last time Shingo was on a Dragon Gate USA show, just to give you reference, it was Brody Lee versus Aki Bono, BB Hulk and Homicide versus Tozawa and Moxley, and Shingo wrestled Shima in a singles match. That's how long he's been gone from this promotion. But the thing with Shingo is he does not miss a beat. He is one of the 10 greatest wrestlers of all time, and he kicked Johnny Gargano's ass in this match, and it was It was an incredible journey to watch. And then the finish happens where the ref goes down, Gargano hits him low, Gargano brings out the rope, he taps Shingo out by nefarious means. And I have to say, I like the finish. And Mike, I don't know what you think of it, but I think for all of the other angles that you could argue were not necessary on this show, the scene breaking up, the Brian Kendrick, Chuck Taylor promo, the John Davis promo, and the angle that that match was, are all unnecessary, because what you need in this company to draw at this point is a main event angle that wants people, that you want to get people to watch the next show, that they need to be focused on the story coming out of this weekend. If I was booking this promotion, I would have done the same exact thing. I don't understand why people have a problem with this. I thought it worked with the story. I thought it was well done. I didn't think it was cringeworthy in the slightest. I thought it was a great angle. I love the finish. 4¾ stars.
You see, I like this match a whole lot. I was 4¼. It's not my match of the night. It's something where I think that opening section where basically with Shingo dominating Gargano, then they went to the floor. It just kind of, for me, like this was, I don't want to use the word superfluous again, but it was one of those things that it just kind of got to a point. It's like, all right, we know what this section is. We know what kind of match this is trying to be. Let's now hit fast forward a little bit. And that took it down for me a little bit. But when this match got going, like the final 10 minutes of this match really got going. Like the late strike exchanges where, for like the first time in the promotion's history, someone is going toe-to-toe Shingo Takagi, and Shingo is the one that is begging off. Like, that was a big moment for Johnny Gargano. And I know that there's now a consensus that Johnny Gargano is bad, that Johnny Gargano has been doing certain kind of matches for like the majority of his career, but I'm not going to say like that this is the original sin here, because when you look at how Gargano has been portrayed as a champion up to this point, I won't say he's dying on the vine, but I'd say he's massively overwhelming. I would say, at least in my opinion, like I came away with so far with the first year of his reign going like, okay, he kind of feels like BB Hulk in a way, and that's not a good thing. It was okay for BB Hulk because he was BB Hulk, but when you're trying to build this company around a native star and you're booking them like BB Hulk was booked in 2009, 2010, it doesn't work. But this finish, I felt like really you needed to have something to shake up Johnny Gargano and his performances here. You very clearly have a moment where you could tell like that he just decides, well, I've given this guy everything. I've taken this guy nearly everything, and I have to get out of this match. I have to escape my title. And then you had the two ref bumps. I forgot that there was a first one to begin with, but the second one, which was like really well timed with how Gargano executed the turn and then what happened post match, I thought was excellent stuff. I went 4¼ on this.
Yeah, I wouldn't change a thing about this. I think it worked. I completely understand Gabe's point of view for wanting to do what he did, and I would be in the same position. I think this is one of the better matches in the history of Dragon Gate USA. It is a testament to Shingo, who's been gone for 3 years at this point, for him to still be the number one Dragon Gate guy, the most over guy on this show. He's unbelievable. It is a testament to him. I think this is the performance that Gargano desperately needed, because I really like him in this match. And I just think this is a terrific way to close out a show that I always consider to be one of the best Dragon Gate USA shows in history. I would say at this point, it's probably one of the best, but I don't look at it as a number one contender anymore. But with Tozawa versus Ricochet and Gargano versus Shingo, this is a really special show.
Yeah, and I don't have... It probably would make my top five list. I would say that's a fair... Probably a top five DGUSA show. Does definitely feel like the last show of huge consequence, I'll say. And I think, like, it's something that, like, 7 years later, I nearly exactly remember, word for word, Johnny Gargano's post-match promo, and Lenny Leonard doing an excellent job just being a gasp. I was like, Johnny, what have you done? Johnny, really? Are you actually doing this there? Really selling this real well. And, you know, it kind of was a very smart thing of like the idea of Gargano feels like he's completely justified in acting like nothing has changed, giving like this almost psychotic, did you have a good time delivery? And I just came away with this. It's interesting because I think I was a lot higher on the show this time than I was in the past, but I don't necessarily have the overall peak that I did before.
I would say I completely agree with all of that. I think Gargano's character performance is awesome, and it's one of those things. I'm very curious to see as we go along how Gargano's heel work ages, because at the time, it was something that people were raving about, and I know there was a match with Rich Swann coming up that right. I'm very curious to see how that holds up, because at the time, that was not only like a great match, but it was one with great Gargano character work, and I'm very curious to see if that remains true as we go along. For now, I think I'm a little bit higher on Gargano than you, but the character work is excellent, the match was excellent. This was a 3.5-hour show. It felt like a Gabe old school, just an old school Gabe show, and it was great.
Yeah. We'll come away with this show as a big success, and it'll be interesting to see how this carries over into a show that I feel like I remember a lot less of.
Yeah, so Mercury Rising 2013, this took place on April 7th, 2013, from the same venue. This show will feature Soldier Ant versus Anthony Nice, just like we all predicted when we started this show. We would be breaking down Soldier Ant versus Anthony Nice, as well as Scott Reed versus Caleb Conley, the Super Smash Brothers versus Eric Cannon and Sami Callihan of the DUF, Brian Kendrick versus Chuck Taylor, the Ladders Are Legal 7-Way Fray Match with Matt Jackson, Nick Jackson, Facade, Christina Von Eri, AR Fox, Samurai Del Sol, and UHA Nation, John Davis versus Orange Cassidy, Shima, Ata, and Tomahawk TT versus Johnny Gargano, Rich Swann, and Ricochet. In your main event, Shingo versus Akira Tozawa. Mike, I've seen this show before, and I only remember the last 5 minutes of the main event. It's like I was Men in Black zapped for this show. I have really no memory of it.
Yeah, I think we're both in the same boat here, bud. This will be an interesting thing to talk about next week. As we've been saying, as we've been going along, now there are only 9 more Dragon Gate USA shows before the promotion is dead. Anything else you want to touch on before we get out of here?
No, I'm really looking forward to these final few shows, especially the last shows of 2013. I just have some very fond memories of whether the shows are good or not. I don't know, but I am just very excited to put a bow on this series. I think these last few shows are going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too. So you can follow us on Twitter at OpenVoiceGate. You can follow Case at _ in your case. And you can follow me at Fujiheya. For Case, I'm Mike. We'll catch you next time on Open the Voice Gate. Rewind and rewatch. Take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.